Welcome to Divorce Talk, a podcast for people who are contemplating divorce, going through one, or would like to know everything about the divorce process. Each episode, you'll hear from Chicago divorce lawyers from Bierman LLP, one of the largest divorce and family law firms in the state of Illinois, speak on all things divorce, from child custody, divorce litigation, mediation, the collaborative process, and everything in between. Now, here are your hosts, the Bierman Divorce Lawyers.
Hello, I'm Sandra Napoli-DiArco. Today we're here with James Quigley and Beth McCormick, and we're speaking about litigation versus alternative dispute resolution options in divorce cases. Before we get started, I'd like to have James and Beth share a little bit about themselves so that the audience and the listeners can learn a little bit more about you.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Beth McCormick. I'm a divorce and family law partner here at Bierman. I've been here for 6 years working alongside James. We have very different styles and approaches, and we're hoping today is illuminating for our audience to see that there's no one approach that fits all.
Great. I'm James Quigley. I've been practicing for about 27 years, been at Bierman since 2005, and I think Beth really summed it up that really what this is about today is that at Bierman, we very much provide a tailored approach. It's not just you come to a lawyer, you're getting a divorce, this is what we do. It's really a look to see what is the family's needs, what is their special circumstances, and how do we tailor an approach that really fits their needs, whether it be litigation, whether it be collaborative, cooperative, mediation. There's many, many different ways to help families in this situation.
And a little more context. So James and I opposed each other for the greater part of our career until I decided to join here as a partner, and we earned one another's respect. We saw how we practice law. We like to show others that there is not this one-size-fits-all approach. And there's very often James may call me in for a meeting. I might call him in because of his specific emphasis in litigation. That's where he shines. And likewise, having done a lot of litigation, I like to think outside the box and use those talents in the ADR or alternative dispute resolution realm.
Great. So this is a great segue because as a layperson, if I'm coming into Bierman and truthfully, I don't understand or know what the different options of divorce are. So James, can you just walk me through the process? If I came to see you and I described my case to you, what are the steps? Do you make the recommendations that this case requires litigation, or how does that work?
Sure. Well, let me start first by saying that while my experience and training and really my forte is more of litigation and trying cases, I fundamentally believe people should try to first avoid that at all costs. And so one of the things that we do at Bierman when we sit down with a client for an initial phone call, an initial interview, is we really try to understand what the issues of the case might be, the personalities, whether or not you're dealing with issues of mental health, addiction problems, you know, some of the things that with our experience, certain processes might be more effective than another. And so as we listen to the client and as we listen to what, you know, their goals are, what they hope to accomplish, we then from there put teams together within our firm to represent the individuals, and we make recommendations in terms of the approach we think is best for the individual client.
Beth, what is the main difference between litigation and alternative dispute resolution?
So as James alluded to, there's every case comes in with a problem to fix, right? So at its heart, it may be that it's a litigation case. One or both of them present in a way that it's clear they can't get their head into problem-solving mode. They have to litigate. Most every case that's litigated is settled. I don't know percentages as we sit here now. Many say upwards of 95% of cases that are even set for trial end up settling. That's just the nature of the work that we do. Yep. So it settles at some point. Some people come into it and say, I'm not going through that at all. I want to get into this problem-solving mode at the very beginning. I don't want to pay lawyers. Everybody's motivated by different things. Alternative dispute resolution affords people privacy. So maybe their situation is such they don't want to air all their dirty laundry in court. They may say, I want to mediate or do collaborative law because everything is done in the privacy of a room. No one is hearing evidence in open court on what your incomes are, what your lifestyle is as it relates to where children are going to live, et cetera. So most generally, to answer the difference between the two is ADR affords people the privacy. Very often you save money. Not always. There's many cases that could be mediated for months. There are many cases that are litigated that are solved relatively quickly. So, but I would say generally speaking, it's privacy, money, and then control.
I think that's
so control is really at the heart of everything. In a ADR, the people are deciding their outcome. Whereas in litigation, mm-hmm. you're giving it up to a judge. But as James will tell you in his litigated cases, ultimately you're giving it up to the judge. But on the day of trial, you may decide, I'm taking control and settling. So James does a ton of work in litigation to prepare for that place, right?
Sure.
James, can you give me an example of a case that is litigated? You had talked about privacy, non-privacy. Many people may not understand what that really means. You know, what does that mean in open court?
Well, fundamentally, it means it is open to the public. Literally, when I'm on trial, I've had people, there are seats in the back of the courtroom. Anybody off the street can come in and sit down and observe a trial. And I've had people do that. So your financial issues are going to come out because you have to introduce evidence during this proceeding. And as you're doing this, you might introduce a tax return of somebody's. You'll be talking about that with a court reporter in open court, where someone just sitting in the gallery would be able to understand how this person makes this much or that person's worth that. Or worse yet, when you're involved in custody issues, you know, sometimes there's some very strange things that we learn about people's personal lives that end up coming out in the context of a trial where you're fighting over child-related issues or relocation, some of that kind of stuff. So to Beth's point, we've represented some very, very well-known individuals here at Bierman. And some of them, people would never know. Some of them might read something in an article about what someone's divorce might speculatively, but they have no idea because it's never been in the court record. It's never been litigated. Everything is behind the scenes. So privacy is a big deal. And I think Beth's comment about control is, I mean, in Cook County alone, downtown Chicago, you probably have 30 plus divorce judges, all different personalities, all different professional backgrounds, political affiliations, you name it. Who your judge is going to be, you have very little control over. And so from one to the next, what one judge is going to decide versus somebody else, you know, it's very, very unpredictable oftentimes. And to me, that's very, very scary, especially when it comes to your children.
So can you talk a little bit more about the control piece with alternative dispute resolution and what that really means?
So when I meet with a new family, I'll put myself in the role of an attorney in alternative dispute resolution. So let's pretend the matter is being resolved via mediation. I'm sitting with the person and preparing them for what do they want, James alluded to, no matter the process. What are your goals? What are your concerns? We're looking at those, and those goals and concerns drive the negotiation. So if your goal is for my child to have stability and continuity, well, if you would go to court and the judge would say, Dad has Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Mom has Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, that doesn't afford stability. So in the out-of-court option, you're looking at creating what schedule makes sense for you. Let's pretend I have Mom. Mom might say, I have to have every Monday and Tuesday because Monday's dance and Tuesday's whatever. You're crafting the agreement you need for your family because you know your family. If a case goes to trial, a judge isn't going to hear those details. If they do, it'll take a very long time, months, maybe years, in order for the court to hear all of that. And even if they hear all the evidence, they still can't know all the nuances of the family and make an informed decision. There's more of a cookie cutter approach, don't mm-hmm. we see very often?
Yeah, from judges, absolutely. They kind of color between the lines. You're not getting a lot of judges that are at trial getting uber creative. I mean, this is what the law is, and you know, you had your chance to try to be creative.
And a lot of times in ADR, we're having people try different schedules. Let's try out this schedule for 3 months and see how you're doing, the kids are doing. And then see, let's pretend they decide, okay, we're going to split the kids 50-50. Well, let's try 1 week on, 1 week off with a dinner in between. Well, they realize that's way too hard on our kids to go that many days without seeing the other parent. Okay, let's try a different way to craft 50-50. So there's a lot of ways that can be done without having the court intervene. And the other thing we didn't allude to at all on the custody side is once you give up control in litigation, you might have an attorney appointed for those kids. And then you're giving up a little bit of control by letting an outside person, another lawyer, come into the negotiation. It's a game changer.
Yeah. Anecdotally, I just spent the last 2.5 hours before coming into this podcast episode having a settlement conference in a case that has been in litigation for years. And it was settled and additional stuff came up, keeps going and going and going. And there's a lot of issues involved. But for the last 2.5 hours trying to settle this, the guardian ad litem who was appointed by the court, who's charging both parties to be here.
Can you explain what the guardian ad litem is?
Sure. The court has the ability when the parents can't agree to a parenting schedule or who makes the decision for kids to appoint either a guardian ad litem or what's called a child's representative. And what you typically do not see is courts appointing a lawyer to represent children, even though a guardian ad litem and a child's rep are attorneys that practice within our division. Beth routinely was appointed and did a lot of that kind of work as well. But it's really someone who's in the position of sort of being the eyes and ears of the court and also an advocate looking for the best interest of the children. There's a little more nuance technically to the difference, you know, if you're a child's representative versus a guardian ad litem. It's an appointment by the court, and it's somebody that the court affords great deference to oftentimes. They listen to that individual because that attorney coming in representing the children appointed by the court is really neutral. I'm not neutral. When I'm representing my client, I'm representing my client, Beth the same, right? We are fighting for our client 100%. And it's not that I don't care about the other client, but I care about my client.
I know you do.
So there's a little bit of a difference. But in this situation, the guardian ad litem was very involved in the process of helping us try to settle this ongoing dispute. Because he, when it goes to trial, if it does, is going to take a position. And it's not going to be, you know, in the middle of the road. You know, at that point in time, he's going to have to generate a report. Based on his findings, he's going to have to make a recommendation to the court. So that's to Beth's point earlier. Even though this has been in litigation, we've been in and out of court, and the parties have spent a lot of money, it still may settle. But, and candidly, with the people involved in this particular case, I'm not sure collaborative or mediation or any of the other alternative forms of dispute resolution really would have been effective because there's some issues that probably would have made that ineffective.
Let me just take that. So some of the issues very often when we're screening on whether a family is appropriate, addiction issues tend to be especially challenging, mental health issues. There are just some cases that we just automatically say they can't do it. That doesn't mean they're bad people. That doesn't mean they're impaired necessarily. But for problem solving, you just can't do it effectively with them. You don't want to charge them to go through that process only to fail. So screening is a really crucial piece. All too often, I think some lawyers will insist on a certain method when it's really not in the client's best interest. Believe it or not, super high conflict families are sometimes best suited for ADR, and that feels counterintuitive to a lot of people. But because often these people are control freaks and they want to control their outcome, so very often they'll say, I am not going to give this up to a judge. Contrary to popular belief, I love doing the super high conflict families. That challenge is great with the right other attorney on the other side, right? Because there are some attorneys that say that they do mediation, et cetera, and they don't do it quite as effectively because it's more of their own personal ego that's fighting rather than their client's needs.
Before coming to see an attorney, do I need to know that I'd like to go and do litigation, or I'd like alternative dispute? Do I need to be armed with that information prior to making an appointment or visiting with you?
Could be, but you hopefully will learn something from the lawyer that you're interviewing to make you, or to help you see it through another lens. I don't go into any new matter looking with an agenda as to what I think is right for them. I hear all of their needs and their concerns, and I have them paint a picture of what life is like at home. All of that helps me decipher what I think is the right approach.
To me, whether they do or they don't need to, first of all. And candidly, we oftentimes have people come to us who have tried to exercise a little bit of self-help, and they've Googled this and Googled that, and you know, they've got a little bit of information. And sometimes you have a lot of misinformation. And so what we hope the client comes to us with is an open mind, that if they understand they're paying us for our experience, our training, and all of the things that we've done to get to this point in our careers, and that they would have some level of trust. And so when we tell them what we're recommending or what we're suggesting, that, you know, if they're open to that, I think it's going to be a little bit better. Sometimes we get people, I want to do this, and I want to do that. And even if you explain the pitfalls to them, they sometimes are just in this type of process are incapable of really hearing you. They're so angry. They're so, you know, into their own issues that they don't always follow our lead. But, you know, we're going to still try to navigate through all of that. And it kind of makes me think of, you know, we've written articles on narcissism. And that's really interesting because someone comes in and they're explaining how their spouse is a narcissist and they're telling you all of the things. And yeah, sounds like a narcissist. And then you start trying to formulate in our mind, what's the best process? And so what I like to do is I still say, in my mind, I'm very cynical away from my experiences. And I think someone with that type of level of narcissism in a mediation or a collaborative approach is going to be very willing to do that because they want to be seen as the, you know, the good person. And, oh yeah, he's this, you know, this charmer is what we always hear.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And so they're going to play along with it. But we've had cases where we've gone very far along. And once you get to the point where the narcissist has to really do what he's supposed to do, but he doesn't want to do, and he can't control it anymore, that's sometimes where you get a rub. So it really takes somebody skilled like Beth to really be able to navigate, understanding who we're dealing with, their personality types or disorders, and kind of knowing that when we start pushing and getting him or her to that point where their personality issues are going to push back a little bit, how do you find ways around that? So
fascinating. James and I both wrote articles on narcissists, and our approaches are almost polar opposite. Neither of them are right or wrong. The best part about it is it's a style. So when people come interview here, we've interviewed people together and they see the yin and the yang. And again, I've never judged James for his style and vice versa. If anything, it's a great compliment. So if I believe, to use the narcissist example, there are ways to give a narcissist what they want because you have to let the narcissist win. James, I think you say, don't let him win. And again, I'm not saying which way is right, but guess what? That spouse knows which way is right, because that spouse knows how to play their husband or their wife, because they've obviously navigated it for years. So they may say, oh, for sure, we need to not give him an inch, because then we're sunk as soon as we do that. Then your approach is more appropriate. And again, it's not like James doesn't shift to my approach and give the narcissist something. It's just more the way... When we wrote the articles, I found it fascinating because we both are seeing it in our practice day in and day out.
Oh, constantly.
Everybody's labeling everybody else as a narcissist.
Have you ever had a situation where both husband and wife are both narcissists?
Well, who are we to say? Because remember, we're just lawyers.
That's interesting.
So do they exhibit narcissistic tendencies? Oh, sure. But as humans, especially humans getting divorced, everybody's very much focused on themselves and self-protection.
I think when you have a real somebody, and again, maybe it's not clinically diagnosed as being a narcissist, but having strong narcissistic tendencies, I don't typically see two of those in a marriage. I typically see someone on the other side, which might be histrionic or very codependent, because a narcissist really needs someone that is codependent on them. And so, and again, all of this talk about mental health issues and so on and so forth, when you start talking about process, you have to have a deeper look and a deeper understanding as to the people you're going to be working with. And that's where I think, you know, Beth, you can maybe talk a little bit about the collaborative approach, where in that process, you can bring in a mental health professional that's viewed as neutral, that can understand those things, you know, even more than we've been able to learn in our
armchair psychology.
Yeah,
so in a collaborative case, but I've also used a coach in litigation or mediation, what you're doing is knowing what you don't know, right? So if a person is struggling, I like to bring a coach in to help me understand how to reach that person. If you have the codependent spouse who's kind of shutting down, they need to gather data, they need to think about what their future might look like, but they're just incapacitated. They're at a place where the divorce is here, but my brain's not functioning. A coach can kind of help them with that. In the collaborative model, the coach is there only as a neutral. So the coach is coaching both the husband and wife. And very often the lawyers, if the lawyers aren't acting appropriately, and a little bit of a referee role, helping everybody navigate many minefields of emotion and managing them to the best they can and having them think forward. A lot of times coaches are reminding me that clients want to get bogged down in their stories. And the more we kind of go down those rabbit holes with them, the less helpful it is. Because if everybody's rehashing their past, which we do day in and day out, we're not really helping them. We need to have them help envision the future. And coaches are really good at kind of reframing that, pivoting, and getting everybody to look forward. I love using coaches for that reason. And then also in collaborative, we have a financial neutral. Having said that, financial neutrals are sometimes used in litigation.
Yeah, so be appointed by the court.
We're always trying to craft a team that saves people money. And that's emotionally on the coach side or financially with the evaluator who works for both sides.
I think if the listeners and viewers take one thing away from that, because we're asked, every client always asks the same question, how long is it going to take and how much is it going to cost? And the two are, I mean, one goes hand in hand with the other. So the longer it takes, whether it, regardless of the process, the more expensive it's going to be. And so I think that's the one thing that people have to understand. What we try to do, whether it's through a litigation approach or an alternative dispute resolution, a mediation, collaborative, cooperative, we try to get people through the process as quickly as we can. Now, a lot of lawyers and other firms don't necessarily share that motivation because it's counterproductive to billable hours, which is how divorce lawyers operate. So if you want to pay less and if you want to have a faster divorce, you have to find a way to be agreeable. And that's really, really difficult when one person can't stand the other, one person's an addict, you know, one person, you name it. You know, it's a very complex subset of the population we're dealing with in this context. So it seems real simple. Hey, just agree upon everything. It's fast, it's inexpensive. But that's truly, really what it comes down to. Because again, litigation, if you get stuck in court, you can be in court easily for a year, 2 years. I've had cases beyond 2 years just to get to trial. You know, Beth could probably tell you stories of cases that have been mediated and collaborative. Maybe they don't go that long. Maybe they do, but certainly they go a long, long time. And it's because it's just people can't get to that point where they're willing to make a concession. You know, they're willing to see, you know, something a little more even. You know, that's really the challenge. And regardless of the process, is getting people to a point of,
I start my case with one process and it's not working and I need to switch to a different process. Is that a possibility? And if so, what is the process of tackling that?
The most typical approach to start is mediation or collaborative. Almost everybody wants to at least try. Let me try to see what we can do. If a team, a collaborative team, which consists of the two lawyers, each party has a lawyer, the coach that we talked about, and the financial neutral. That team approach, if by chance they don't reach full terms, everybody is excluded from helping the family move forward. So it's a disqualification provision. Each of the lawyers and their whole firms cannot help that family moving forward. But some people are like, why would I spend all that money, put all my eggs in that basket, only if we don't reach terms, we're done. I think that's exactly, to James' point, why people should do it, because they do have the answer, even though there's many, many hurdles and they feel like they can't ever reach terms. They can, and everybody's got skin in the game. So I, as a lawyer, I don't get to walk you down the hall to my litigation partner when we're done. So I make money, let's pretend, on mediation, and then I make money in litigation. In collaborative, everybody, it's called a limited scope engagement. We're done right there. And I find that people who are equipped to do it really like it. On the other side, I've had people drop out of litigation and come to me for the collaborative approach because they saw the devastation, they saw the money and the time, and they said, we want to sign up for this process and let's get it done. It's not nearly as common, but it does happen. I'm sure you could say in litigation, you pull out and go to mediation all the time.
And I think what you said to start is we try to avail ourselves of some out-of-court means before we start fighting it out. Because it just, once you get in court, generally you stay in court. Judges want to see you back every month for statuses and updates. The discovery process goes. So to me, I'm not as pushy in terms of which form. Like, some people really want to work with a mediator. When there's finances involved, I strongly advise clients to work through attorney-assisted mediation, where the attorneys are there in the mediation process. When it comes to the children, I'm less concerned about that because I think parents with a good mediator can resolve how they want to raise their children. The collaborative, or sometimes you can take in a collaborative approach, but if they don't do it with all of the formalities so that you don't have to change firms, you know, Beth would tell you that's not the purest way to do it, but sometimes we've done it that way. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we had lawyers in my office today with the parties and we had settlement conferences for 2.5 hours. And, you know, to me, the real benefit to Bierman is we've got such tremendously talented lawyers who just have different styles, like Beth mentioned before. I believe in all of this stuff that Beth does. And no, I really do.
I know you do.
But I'm just not wired that way. I mean, candidly, you know, I'm a fighter. Let's filter it down. What's the issue? Let's solve the issue kind of person. My head would explode sitting in a mediation for 8 hours where you got whiteboards and, you know, snacks on the table and all this stuff, you know? So, but I think it's a great process. It just, I'm not well suited for that process. You want to go fight? I'm your guy.
But if the client comes to you looking for an approach, going back to you pivot, you've got a really strong team of lawyers that you're going to create the right team for that client.
Yeah.
So a client who wants the fighter to feel protected, he's there. He's always going to be there. But if you want to soft sell for a little bit, you're over there. They're working on that side. Mm-hmm. And then when it's time to fight, I do it a lot. I'll bring James in and say, okay, this is what it's going to look like. Next thing you know, the client's back to, oh no, we got to stay soft. Because ultimately it's going to cost them, obviously financially, but also emotionally. That family's devastated after that. They certainly can't imagine it sitting in their children's wedding together or anything like that in the future because they've just devastated one another.
Yeah. And that really, to me, I think what Beth says too, is having us work at teams at Bierman, it is really, really effective. And I can tell you the number of times Beth or one of my partners, Shannon Vitek, where they get to a point in an alternative dispute process where they say, fine, Quigley's going to take over now. And the lawyer said, no.
Not because they understand.
I mean, this is the direction that we'll go. And it sometimes causes people to think twice whether you really want to kind of blow up that process before you actually go.
Let me talk briefly about, we mentioned cost several times throughout this podcast. What are the differences between litigation and alternative dispute?
For me, I'm not sure there's much of a difference because time is money. Collaborative in its purest form, people are cooperating and they're they're transparent, in other words, in litigation. I got to pull information like I'm pulling teeth. I got to send subpoenas. I got to take people's depositions. I've got to hire investigators sometimes to get information. If people are voluntarily bringing that to the process, you're saving time, you're saving money. In theory, my hourly rate, Beth's hourly rate, doesn't change from one process to the next. But if in my process I'm doing 100 hours worth of work and Beth is doing 50 hours worth of work, you know, do the math, it's just going to be less expensive. So to me, it's really, you hear this, you know, adage all the time, time is money. And that's really regardless of the process. So again, it kind of circles back to that. How quickly can you get to a point of resolution? Don't care what the process is. If you don't have transparency in any process, you're not going to get a resolution done. I need to know, Beth needs to know the same facts. How much do people earn? What assets do they have? Are they marital? Are they non-marital? I mean, there's, you know, we have to have the basic set of facts that we're operating off of. And so if that can be produced voluntarily, you're going to save time and you're going
to
save money.
So to build on time is money as an adage, another is knowledge is power. So unless you have the knowledge of all the data that James alluded to, you're not in a position to negotiate. So another common misconception is if you're doing any form of ADR, you never get all the data. Well, James will tell you in litigation, there's no guarantee that you ever got all the data either. Ultimately, we both have the parties sign an affidavit saying they disclosed everything. If later it's determined that somebody hid something, it's the same remedy to rectify it. So we try hard to help people see that just because you're pulling out of court doesn't mean that you are getting any less data. I'm just as vigilant as James in ensuring that all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed and that everybody has the same knowledge. Mm-hmm. There's no shortcuts by doing ADR.
Okay. So just to close, can you offer just maybe three takeaways for people, whether they're choosing litigation or whether alternative dispute resolution is their direction? What are the top things people really should think about before they pick up the phone and make an appointment with you?
Well, I don't know if I have a top three, but it's kind of generally speaking, when you come in and interview a divorce lawyer, and assuming you have some information, little information or none at all, it doesn't really matter. You first and foremost want to come to a firm like Bierman that has the resources at a very, very top level to be able to provide whichever process works best for you and your family. So that's number one. And not every lawyer, not every law firm has that ability the way we do. So that to me, I think is really, really important, because if you don't have options and you go see a sole practitioner, he's a litigation lawyer, he's going to say, this is what we do. And that might not really be best. So really, get yourself to someone that has different, you know, resources within that same firm. That's very, very valuable. Number two, ask your attorney that you're interviewing about those processes so that you have an understanding of how they work. Because, and we've kind of just touched the surface on what the different processes are and how they really work. There's so much more depth to litigation, to collaborative, to mediation, that you really have to understand it a little so that, like Beth said before, knowledge is power. You want to be making an informed decision, both with the lawyer you select, the process that you're going to go. And then number three, and I'm going to add a fourth, but number three is listen to your lawyers. If you're hiring them and you're paying them, and like Beth and I, 27, 28 years of experience each, you know, that's a lot of experiences we've had. We know what we're doing. We have different styles and different approaches, but hear us. And that's really what you're paying for. And then last thing, I just want to add this in. Make sure you understand, as a person coming to hire a lawyer, that the money that you're going to spend, there's never a situation where it's, oh, we're going to make him pay for the lawyers or her pay for the lawyers. It doesn't work that way. More often than not, the money that's being paid in a divorce, I don't care what process is selected, is coming out of the estate. Don't be misled. Understand that if you spend $100,000 on your side and your husband spends $100,000, that $200,000 is just coming directly out of the marital estate. I pay each lawyer $10,000 and say, you get an extra $90,000, you get $90,000. Don't be misled on some of the stories about who's going to pay for attorney's fees. You're all paying for it.
which brings up the stories I'm always trying to remind people at the beginning that they will hear. Some lawyers tell them what they want to hear. We at Bierman are very cautious to not do that because we want to set the expectation at the beginning as to their possible outcomes. So at the end of the day, we can accomplish the vast majority of their goals. We're not trying to sell them on something that we know we can't achieve. Be careful of the Greek chorus, the proverbial Greek chorus. So everybody's got their story of who they went to and why this lawyer's great and that lawyer's great. I don't dissuade people from it. I think you know who you can trust and who you can't. Keep a really sharp look, though, at what those people's motivations are, because very often it's not always that person's best interest that they're looking at. So everybody's got their own story. Every case has its own story. And to try to compare me to your cousin's divorce probably is not a good use of time. And it ultimately costs money. We make a lot of money on people calling and saying, well, what about this and what about that? To James' point, you have to listen to your lawyer. And then I guess my last piece of advice is really keep control over your outcome by considering an out-of-court settlement up to and including the last day of right before the trial starts. Really ponder what is at stake and don't spend $3 to save a dollar. Really be thoughtful about where you spend your money.
I can add one more thing. I'm over my three, but what is a recurring theme of when I've had clients, they've hired other lawyers, other firms, and they come to us, things haven't gone well. And I ask the question, I said, what was the strategy you had? Mm-hmm. And they look at you sort of the deer in the headlights. Like, what do you mean? What strategy? Yeah. Like, what was the plan when you hired that lawyer? What did that lawyer say? Okay, here's what we're going to do. If this happens, then we'll do that. If that happens. So from our perspective, part of an initial consult, if you're hiring us and we're going to be your lawyers, we have to have a plan of action. We have to have a strategy. You should walk away from that interview having some sense of what we're doing and what why. The end game is. Yeah.
So that we're not going down a rabbit hole looking, again, spending the $3 to get the one. Mm-hmm. They need to know why we're doing what we want to do when. And we're laying out that strategy day one. And we're having many meetings in between explaining it.
Yep.
I lied. I have one more question. Is there a fee for a consultation?
For me, it's sometimes. And where I typically charge a consultation fee is if someone isn't really ready to move forward and they just want to take an hour of my time, fair. I'm happy to give my thoughts and impressions. But I typically would charge someone for that. If someone says, listen, I was referred to you by so-and-so and I want to get moving, or as I just received a call from a woman yesterday, said I've been served and, you know, it was referred to me. Come on in. I'm not going to charge you for that consultation. It's more for me administrative. Let's talk through the process. Let's develop our strategy. Let's get the general information we need to get going. And away we go. And so in that context, I generally won't.
I am identical. I more often than not will waive it as a courtesy, but there are instances where I have to charge it. The client knows it well in advance. No one gets blindsided.
Yep.
Right. Yep. Well, thank you. This has been fascinating. If you'd like to learn more about James and Beth, please go to Bierman's site, www.biermanlaw.com. Please follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn and subscribe to our podcast channel. Thank you. And this isn't the last that you'll hear of James and Beth. They'll be back talking about different divorce topics. Thank you again.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Divorce Talk. Visit our website at www.biermanlaw.com, where you can subscribe to the show so you'll never have to miss a single one. Please also follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn and subscribe to our YouTube channel. If you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating. Be sure to tune in next time for another enlightening episode.